Welcome back from lunch. We're so glad you all have come back from lunch and found your way here. And we're fortunate to have a great slate of speakers this afternoon. First off, John Hagen from Northwestern University and Holly Foster from Texas A&M. You're doing a joint presentation, I understand. Great, thank you.
Just use these microphones. Will they work? Can you hear us? Back on the bleachers. Okay. So I started the day by dropping my hard copy and then had to sort it out again. And then I forgot my glasses. So if this makes any sense at all, you'll be lucky. But especially following such great presentations this morning, this has been really informative. I'll just start with probably a graph you all do know, but want to make a point. This sort of, you know, we do now begin to see the other side of this peak in a mountain, hopefully, and sort of a bending of the curve. And this is, you know, encouraging on the one hand, but many of you probably also know that, like everything in America, things don't unfold evenly. And this figure is making the point that there are probably 10 or 12 states that are really significantly maybe beginning to decrease incarceration on a scale of maybe 10% or more. But then at the other end, there are still 10 or so states that are actually still increasing incarceration. And the other thing that intrigues me about this is someone somewhere can better inform me about is I'd have just assumed, you know, that California would lead the way following the 2011 Brown v. Plata court decision mandating that reduce the population by 45,000 inmates in California. And they've mostly done that, or they've made a lot of progress on it. But actually still New York and New Jersey have done more, which is of interest in, you know, in a field where we have lots of not-so-pleasant things to discuss, important to keep in mind. So we're going to go back and forth.
Okay, so another trend in the mass incarceration literature is its gender distribution, with 93% of the incarcerated population being male. However, women comprise 7% of the incarcerated population, and less is known, as Kreshnet and others have pointed out, that their experience about their experiences has been ascertained in the literature. Women are comprise an important minority of those incarcerated, as their rates are growing, as can be seen in this figure. And almost two-thirds of female inmates are mothers of minor children. So a focus on both men's and women's incarceration is needed in research on looking at criminal justice involvement effects on health, given these trends. So our presentation aims to look at the effects of adult incarceration on individuals, families, and communities. And so we begin with the effects on individuals. So regarding adult incarceration, there's been a lot of work that's been done predominantly on male incarceration that's looked at associations with diminished earnings, barriers to employment, risk of divorce, diminished political participation, housing insecurity, and homelessness. Furthermore, men's incarceration has been linked to depressive symptoms and also psychiatric disorders. And recently, an article has shown that maternal incarceration is associated with women's poorer self-rated health using fragile families data. The second area of effects of incarceration include those on the family, and we've kind of split this into two sections. First, there are effects of male individuals who are affecting the female partners of those men. In that vein, there's been research, Megan Comfort's work, Doing Time Together, regarding the impact of men's incarceration on female spouses and partners and her concept of secondary prisonization. There's also been work done by Wildeman and colleagues on paternal incarceration effects on diminished maternal mental health, and Turney and colleagues on paternal incarceration effects on reduced in-kind support for mothers. The second area of parental incarceration effects look actually at families and children in relation to families and children. And we know from national data that over half of adult prisoners are parents of minor children. So regarding parental incarceration effects on families, people have looked at things like financial strains, including the work of Schwartz, Socher, and Geller and colleagues, and family processes and relationships. Again, RDD gives an overview of this area, and Turney does some work on maternal harsh parenting. Regarding effects on children, okay, this slide is misplaced. Sorry. Okay, right there. Regarding maternal and paternal effects on children, this grid is really showing a summary of recent research of paternal and maternal incarceration effects on children. So the outcomes indexed here in the columns are children's internalizing and externalizing problems and indices of children's social exclusion and marginalization. On the right-hand side, we've got the maternal, or to the left-hand side, we've got the maternal imprisonment and paternal imprisonment. The first row shows the effects of maternal incarceration. Risk effects of maternal incarceration have been found in the literature for externalizing and internalizing symptoms, as well as educational deficits. But importantly, both null and heterogeneous effects have also been observed regarding maternal incarceration in these realms for children, specifically around behavioral problems and homelessness. The findings tend to be more consistent for the bottom row regarding paternal incarceration. A broad range of studies have shown risk effects on children's internalizing and externalizing behavior problems, and recent work on risk effects of paternal incarceration include outcomes in the realm of social exclusion, including educational deficits, homelessness, and also powerlessness.
So a lot of the work that Holly and I have done has been with the National Longitudinal Study of Adolescent Health, or Ad Health. And, whoops, there we go. And I thought it'd be worthwhile to just sort of say a little bit about how that work got started. I'd been on the faculty at the University of North Carolina in the mid-1990s, and shortly after that, was asked to be on an advisory board for Ad Health. And it was very much the kind of sort of deliberation that's occurring here about whether it would be useful to have anything about criminal justice experiences on the Ad Health survey. Or at least I was making that argument that it would be useful to have them. And of course, no one else in the room was really had that background or interest. And so they're very incredulous about it. And I should mention one other thing about the Ad Health study. It had had its share of successes and failures. It had actually been funded earlier during the Bush administration. Some of you may know this story. And the demographer involved with it, Udry in particular, had done a lot of work on this, and Peter Bierman and Kathleen Harris Mullins. But it got to the final stage, and the Secretary of Health, at this final point where they're about to announce the grant and start the study, said, no, we're not going to do this, violate problems, anonymity, confidentiality, things like that. So there have been a lot of ups and downs. And finally, they'd gotten it going again in the 90s during the Clinton administration, stuck with it, which is a lesson in perseverance. Of course, it's been a hugely funded study, and multiple now, going to its fifth wave, and an enormous amount of data collection used for all sorts of different purposes. But of course, their question was, you know, would really there be a significant number of people who would affirmatively indicate that, say, their parent had been in jail or prison? And there was a lot of debate about that. And finally, they decided, I think, just to allow this one question, you know, to sort of test the waters on that. And so in the first wave, it immediately became apparent that something like 10-12% had some sort of experience in jail or prison. This is, I think, the fourth wave results. And overall, 13% of whites, I should say, 18% of the Hispanic youth reported a father having been in jail or prison, and nearly a quarter of the African American youth. So the distribution was higher than they had anticipated, I think, at all in their deliberations. And I was reminded of that when Chris was proposing his question, self-report question, thinking about what would be the response to that. The fact is, we don't know, but it likely would be significant and highly useful. I just want to say a couple things about the organization of Ad Health, why we found it a fascinating survey to work with. There are, of course, reasons why it's not the ideal survey, and some of the pros and cons of different kinds of surveys were raised this morning. But a great advantage of this survey is it began in 95, with the youth being about 15 years of age. So that meant that they were born at just about the point where this mountain on the right side of the graph begins to rise. So it captures a long period in which mass incarceration has been going on. It's also significant that now it includes a period, and this was in the fourth wave of the Great Recession. And the interviews that were done for the fourth wave of Ad Health unfolded basically from a month or two before, I think, the Great Recession was officially designated as having set in, and went on for the bulk of the interview period after that. So it's an interesting survey in a number of different ways.
Okay, so a little bit more about the design of the Ad Health study. It's a school-based study. It's longitudinal in design. It's a nationally representative sample of adolescents who were in grades 7 through 12 in the United States in 1994-95. And data have been collected from adolescents, but also their fellow students in the first wave, school administrators in the first wave, parents in the first wave, siblings, friends, and romantic partners through multiple data collection components, including four respondent in-home interviews. So as is shown on the left-hand side there, the study is longitudinal beginning in 1994 to 95, and the fourth wave is 2007 to 2008, and there is going to be a fifth wave of this study, which is really exciting. Respondents were tracked from ages 11 to 21 to ages 24 to 32 in 2007-2008. This recruitment effort resulted in a pair of schools in each of 80 communities, and there's about 200 students per school, and there are around 132 schools in the core study, well, exactly 132 in the core study. So talking about measuring incarceration, parental incarceration in this study, this is some of the questions that were included. In wave three, there was just the key single question that John alluded to, have your biological father ever served time in jail or prison? And in wave four, this question was asked regarding biological father and biological mother. So it was a window into both male and female incarceration. Other questions that were asked, we got a little bit of information on reliability of asking this question of adolescents regarding their parents. And so we noted that the correlation in the reports of paternal imprisonment specifically between waves three and four is 0.63, a correlation of 0.63. If you exclude new onset cases at wave four, the correlation is 0.82. So a little bit of information there. There's also a question that kind of taps this concept of chronicity, or how many times has your biological mother and also asked of the father in jail or prison? And so for the mother, this ranged from 1 to 20 times, and for fathers, this ranged from 1 to 53 times. It's not going to get at duration of spells, but trying to get at the total amount of time the parent was sort of involved with the system. How old was your biological mother or father when they went to prison the first time? How old were you when your biological mother or father went to prison the last time? We should also note there is there's some questions that are embedded in the survey. They haven't really been used, but they're also on a non-biological father figure and a non-biological mother figure, and it's kind of difficult to use those questions because it's not clear some of the control variables who they're pertaining to. But that information is also available in the data set.
Okay. What we'd like to do next is talk a little bit about some of the findings and recent work that we've done. You know, it used to be I thought the most traumatic part of being an academic was revise, resubmit, and rejection. I've now learned that as I get older, the challenging part is remembering what you've done. You know, especially as these papers go through the stages, the life course of revise, revision, and resubmission. So we'll see if I can remember what we've done. We're going to talk about three studies. Fortunately, I only have to talk about two of them. One of them involves issues of economic and food insecurity, and this is a paper that appeared last year in the Russell Sage New Journal of Social Sciences. The second is a study we're just finishing and hope to begin the revision, revise, and rejection process with on receipt of health services. And the third is on college access and completion, and we're interested in talking about these three studies because they try to do different things, and I think hopefully indicate some of the possibilities and importance of this kind of research that we're trying to encourage and facilitate in this kind of a panel. So the first of these studies is dealing with economic and food insecurity, and involves a series of questions in AdHealth that ask people whether they're able to pay, have had trouble being able to pay for their phone bills, their rent or their mortgage, their utility bills, or had trouble having money just to get food. These are sort of, if you think about it in terms of sort of human security more broadly and human rights, which I occasionally try to do, these represent kind of basic sort of things in a developed society, things that we expect people that mostly would be able to accomplish and have access to in advanced developed societies such as the United States. What we're interested in this first slide is just in simply making the point that having these things is problematic, especially for people whose parents go to prison, and in particular ways for people whose mothers go to prison. And so if I focus your attention on the two bars on the right-hand side of the table, these represent children of mothers who have been incarcerated at two different points in time, in 01 and 02, the third wave, and in 07, 08, the period of the Great Recession, in the fourth wave. And if we code the data and analyze it in terms of experiencing any one of the four forms of economic and financial insecurity, we see that up to 40% of the children of mothers who have been incarcerated have problems with one or more of these things. And it's higher in 07, 08 than it was in 01, 02, as we might expect. And it's true both in terms of paternal incarceration and maternal incarceration. We're particularly interested in the maternal part of this because, as Holly indicated and as Chris and Sarah Wakefield's work has indicated, the results on maternal incarceration are much less consistent than on paternal incarceration. And we saw something here that was going on with the mothers. We were interested in this, and it turns out to be food insecurity. Someone made a reference to this earlier today, sort of saying, you know, the role of mothers in reminding you that you should eat or have enough food or go to the hospital or get medical attention, things like that. These are lasting influences and important in people's lives. And so this slide is simply making the point then during the Great Recession, 07 through 08, fourth wave of this survey. About a fourth of the children of mothers who have been incarcerated had some difficulty in terms of having access to food. So we think that's pretty important. And then the last of these slides is to try to sort of quickly make the point that these findings hold up under an array of controls. We've done some fixed effects modeling in this part of the paper and also have a broad range of controls that we control, that we consider. Even with all of the controls that we bring into the analysis, we find that the net effects of in terms of having any one of these four problems, or more specifically, having a problem in relation to food, are still quite high, something on the order of 1.5 to 2 times more likely to have one of these forms of insecurity if a mother has been incarcerated. So Holly now will talk about some health effects.
Yes. So building on some recent research on criminal justice system linkages to healthcare receipt, the work of Brain, Goffman, and Laura Millen, we have been investigating the association between parental incarceration and the receipt of healthcare services by AdHealth young adults. So this figure is showing that fewer young adults received medical services when they needed them if they had an incarcerated parent. This disparity is especially clear for children of incarcerated mothers. So we found about 60% of young adults who had a mother incarcerated and needed medical services received those services in the past 12 months at wave 4. However, more young adults, 75% of those who did not have a mother incarcerated, received medical services when they needed them. Therefore, children of incarcerated mothers are at a significantly elevated risk of not receiving the health care they need. This figure is showing the results of multivariate analysis, logistic regression analysis, showing that the odds ratios of receiving medical care when needed. The first bar in the figure shows maternal incarceration reduces the odds of receipt of medical services when needed, net of an array of controls. We found the next bar that health insurance mediates about 6% of this effect. However, as shown in the third bar, economic marginality explains 32% of this effect, reducing the effect of maternal incarceration to non-significance. So economic marginality and health insurance both contribute to mediating the effects of maternal incarceration on healthcare receipt, but the pathway through economic insecurity and marginality is especially pronounced for maternal incarceration. We also found in this paper that African Americans were less likely to receive health care when needed than were non-Hispanic whites. And we found that 17% of this racial disparity was explained by access to health insurance, while 28% of this effect was explained by economic marginality. Economic marginality, therefore, explains parts of both maternal incarceration and also racial and ethnic disparities in the receipt of health care services.
Okay, the last of these studies has to do with some attempt to get at community or school effects. In doing this, I wanted to draw attention to one of the unique features of the AdHealth study is this large number of schools that are involved, something on the order of 80 to 100, depending on the how you sift the data, but a large number of schools, and we wanted to, in looking at these schools, try to make the point that there are effects of being in a school where a large number of the students, a large number of the children, have had a parent incarcerated, and so it's not just the parents of incarcerated. It's not just the children of incarcerated parents, but also the children of parents who are unincarcerated, but in a school that has a large number of children who have been incarcerated. The kind of distinction that Todd Clear has made in referring to these schools is sometimes becoming prison places or prison kinds of places. Thinking also about what kind of sort of expectations kids in these schools might have, for example, in terms of about their educational mobility. So if we go back, if we go back to looking at the number of schools, you can see that they range all the way from having almost no one, having a parent who's gone to prison, to a very high proportion, upwards of 20 and 30%. The higher bars are for having fathers incarcerated. The lower bars are for having mothers incarcerated. So you could sort of think of the left side of this figure as being much like the high schools that many of us went to. I'll guess a majority in this room, a large majority in this room, went to a school with very few parents, very few of the parents having gone to jail. The right side of this figure represents the other extreme, places like on the south side of Chicago, where very high proportions of students have parents who have gone to prison. What we were trying to do in this research was to make the point that this does make a difference. And so the left two bars in this table are parents in schools more like those that many of us went to. I think of New Trier High School, the sort of classic school in those movies that Tom Cruise and Ferris Bueller and so on went to, you know. And actually, New Trier, about 90%, I think, of the kids go on to college and probably complete college. But overall, that sort of middle mass of schools in America, about half the kids go on to college and graduate. If they have a father who's been in prison, only about 25% of the kids in those schools go on to college and graduate. Now, if we look at those other schools at the other end of the spectrum, and we look at the kids whose parents don't go, who haven't been in prison, we see that already they're down to about 25% of them going to college and graduating. So they're going to a school that's difficult and challenged, but their parents have not been involved, at least to the point of going to prison in the criminal justice system. In those schools, the children who have had parents, a father who's been in prison, the level of going to college is down around 12%. So dramatic differences both at the individual level and at the school level. And I don't think we've had that much empirical work that gets at these kind of contextual effects. And so we want to make a push for more of that kind of work.
This is still you.
Okay. Back to me. So we actually tried to do something with the results of this last study. And I do some of my work at the American Bar Foundation in Chicago, and we have these lawyers across America who are designated as fellows, largely for fundraising purposes, but they also get involved and often want to do good things and help out in terms of the goals of the American Bar Foundation, which have to do with the use of social science research for legal change.
You don't donate, John?
Not yet. No. I'm sure I will. Thank you. But you will. One of the fellows who's somewhere in Massachusetts was doing kind of pro bono work, acting in sort of legal defense work for people on trial or at the point of sentencing in this case, who had no legal defense otherwise. And he heard a presentation that I made about this last piece of work. And he said, well, you know, could you summarize all of that in the slide? Well, of course, it took us about 6 months to get anything like this summarized in a slide that both made sense to us and more, and also for him. But he then did use this in a case, and he actually got the judge to lower the sentence in this particular case by convincing the judge that the parent going to jail would have detrimental effects in terms of the educational prospects of the child involved. So we're sort of pushing this and trying to see if we can get something more in the area of an experimental or quasi-experimental, probably, sort of approach to testing this out more broadly.
So we wanted to close with thinking about some of the societal benefits of government investment in measuring incarceration effects on health outcomes. And there's been a lot of investment in the National Longitudinal Study of Adolescent and Adult Health. And so we were really thinking about some of those benefits that have accrued. And so one is a slide that John has shown, was thinking about Elder's life core principle of historical time and place, and really thinking that these children in the adolescent health sample are children of mass incarceration who also endured the Great Recession, and the importance of tapping into their experiences. Also, AdHealth is a nationally representative sample that yields estimates and effects on paternal and maternal incarceration, as well as individual incarceration in its varied forms, from police stops through contacts, through conviction, through incarceration that Wendy was talking about. But it provides these estimates with a general community school-based sample. Paternal incarceration effects have been measured at waves 3 and 4. In terms of spillover effects, estimates of parental incarceration effects in schools on those with and without an incarcerated parent, so we're able to start to tap into some of those contextual spillover effects, as well as family spillover effects. This broad-scale study permits investigation of mediating pathways. So we've heard that we need more research on these mediating pathways, which I would agree with. But we found there's been some mediation through education in our work to date, as well as economic deprivation. Furthermore, the AdHealth study allows an investigation of health-specific and broad-scale outcome effects on young adults. Importantly, it's a longitudinal sample. It has the potential to investigate effects from adolescent to the later adult life course. And it also provides us information into racial and ethnic disadvantage, which documents that because minority youth are more exposed to incarceration of fathers, they are also more impacted by all the generic and cumulative effects that follow from the incarceration of fathers.
I think we're done, aren't
yes.
we?
Yes.
Okay, our next presenter is Chris Hugin from University of Minnesota.
Okay, great. Whoops. So somebody else is doing that, right?
Okay.
Good.
I named it. It's at the very bottom. With all
of it. Hugin.
Yeah. Yep.
That's me.
Okay.
Well, yeah, Chris was saying the pre-lunch spot is bad. I think the post-lunch nappy time slot is also a challenge. So thank you very much for inviting me. I am really moved and honored to be here. A little bit nervous having so much brain power on the table, but I'll try my best. Let me see. So as many people have talked about, a lot of what the researchers in my area have been doing is arguing about selection versus causation. I came to this study partly through Mike Masolia. We worked together at the University of Minnesota, and Jason Schnitker. The work I'll be talking about involves a lot of collaborators and folks, some of whom are formerly incarcerated themselves, who I've been writing with. I was also really moved to get into this area with Evelyn Patterson. I don't know if I've told you about this, Evelyn, but your work on mortality was very influential for me to think, got me thinking about kind of that question Dan was asking, what's the counterfactual? If we're looking at mortality rates of prisoners, who should we be? Who's the relevant comparison group? And I think Evelyn's work was extremely important there. The project I'll be talking about a great deal of it came from some work with Jason Schnitker that Robert Wood Johnson has been funding, but it's part of a larger agenda really to identify excess punishment, over punishment. We need punishment. Crime is real. Crime is important. But I think we're kind of in the market politically for ways to pare back the system in ways that will not compromise public safety. I'll say more about that in a moment. I've done a bit of work on collateral sanctions over the years, and I think it's important to draw and connect the dots with health. In particular, employment restrictions on people with criminal records I think it's almost too strong an effect to call it an indirect effect on healthcare and the healthcare system. As well, some of the social, civic, political restrictions that affect people with criminal records. Now, a lot of these collateral sanctions, things like not being able to vote, which I've written on, or not being able to get an occupational license, they've been studied in isolation, and I've been guilty of that. You know, we'll write about one restriction, but people experience them in combination. It's a whole package, and it's fairly daunting if you look at it. I use the language, and I apologize for the reference to American football, but of piling on. The player is down, but you've got a bunch of people piling on at the end, which is illegal because it slows the game's progress, it's unnecessary, and it's injurious. And I'll give you an example of that. I sometimes use restrictions on welfare receipt for people convicted of crimes as an example of piling on. This one I'll take just from my own experience testifying on behalf of six probationers in Minneapolis fairly recently. They were all described as model probationers, but they'd been called into court that day for voting. They had voted while they were on probation. Now, one of the defendants was on probation for 10 years, and he voted after 9 years and 10 months of successfully completing his probation term. Yet he was being charged with a new felony. It is a felony to vote when you are disenfranchised. And so this is an example. Now, and I looked around and sat next to a defendant, and I thought, you know, what a waste, right? You've got all this assembled brain power, the full weight of the American criminal justice system, and you're pulling folks in off the job to come in and do this. So these collateral sanctions are real. I got curious enough. I looked up over 200 people in Minnesota had been convicted of illegal voting. I can go into their fines and what kind of sanctions they got. But it is a felony. Nobody got 5 years of prison, which was what they could have been punished for, but they were convicted of that. So collateral sanctions matter. And I just want to show you a little bit of the combination. It's going to be fairly loosely constructed, but here's a guy. Michael had a felony DWI. That's usually the case that he had multiple DWIs. He had an alcohol problem and he continued to drive, so that's usually third or fourth conviction. But he sobered up. He went to school. It's not easy to get into school if you have a felony conviction, particularly these days. More colleges are asking. I'm fielding an experimental audit on that even as we speak. But he was able to kind of make his way through from community college to a four-year college, got a social work degree, and then couldn't get a license. He had to petition the board to get the license. He got the license, and then he had to get a job, and that wasn't easy. But he gets a job, he moves his family to northern Minnesota, somebody on the county commission took issue with the fact that he was working for them, and they pulled him into the office, and they said he's a good social worker, but they didn't think he fit. So he was out, and now he's working again as a social worker. But you can see, now this is a series of hoops and hurdles through which people with records have to go. And he did have very good health insurance when he was a social worker. But then when he lost that, he lost it and his family did. Alex is an example of kind of a post-release collateral sanction. Among the collateral sanctions that we have, you can be deported. And so he had arrived illegally with his parents from Mexico. He was adjudicated for statutory rape at 16, and went through the juvenile justice system, had no further contact with the system, but it came to the attention of immigration authorities that he had failed to register as a sex offender, which is a condition of his release. And so he's currently in detention and could be deported. So we have a mix of collateral sanctions. Some of them are merited. Some of them make a lot of sense for public safety. But others are capturing a large number of people who may not pose a threat to public safety. So I'll say a bit about the scale and some of the demographic estimates of people with criminal records. Mine will be smaller than what Wendy said. I'm going to focus primarily today on people with a prison record, so sent to a state penitentiary, a federal penitentiary. I'll say something about felons as well, and then say a bit on individual and community health effects, and present a bit of my work with Mike and with others. Talk about the healthcare system for a moment, and then, if time permitting, some of the policy choices ahead. So working on felon disenfranchisement, it became important to try to measure how many people were out there who had a criminal record that would not allow them to vote. And so started doing demographic standard life table estimates. We do have a lot of data in the system, correctional data. As Mike said, you get a count every day, and you know who leaves and who comes in. But we don't really have a national registry that says individuals who have a history of prison in the record. But we've tried to compile these for the nation as a whole, both for people with a prison record and for people with a felony conviction. And we've tried to look a bit at disparities, although I will say that the data on race and ethnicity are rather spottily collected and reported. So if the assumptions of our model are correct, we estimate there's about 5 million former prisoners in the United States, I'll show in a moment how they're spread across the states. This, if we add up the current prisoners with the former prisoners, we get about 6% of adult males with a history of a prison record or exposure to prison, if we think of it that way, and about 15% of African American adult males. But there's a spatial story as well as a racial story, which I'll show you in a moment. One thing I just want to point out, and this only goes through 2010, I've got the prisoners here, the current prisoners and the ex-prisoners, but the ex-prisoners are going to continue to rise for a while, even as the criminal or the current prisoners have leveled off in the last five years or so. Here's what it looked like in 1980. About 0.5% of the voting age population had a history of a prison record in their past, but were released. You can see there's a little bit of concentration in the Southeast. By 2010, this had changed to about 2% of the voting age population, or 4% of males. And you can see here again that concentration in the South, there's a greater degree of former prisoners. These are model-based. We're modeling migration, we're modeling recidivism, and we're modeling mortality here. If we look at African American former prisoners, these rates have been high for a very long time. I mean, I've looked back to 1850 or so, but the geography is quite a bit different. And so about 3.3% of African American males in even as early as 1980. By 2010, it's up to about 7% of the voting age population, over 10% of the African American voting age population, and pretty much the whole nation has 5% or more. If we go though to this, as Chris was saying, you know, that prison is really just the tip of the iceberg here. It's very important if we're looking at the health effects of incarceration, but if you're worried about the stigmatizing effect of a criminal record, then the felony conviction is a real salient marker. And so if we look at African Americans with a history of felony conviction, it's about 18% of the voting age population, or about 25% of the African American male voting age population. And I would point out too that the geography here is different, and so some of the worst offending states or the most disparate states are the north central states like Minnesota, Wisconsin, where there's a relatively low base population but a very high racial disproportionality in criminal justice, as well as very long probation sentences and putting many people on probation. To say that, I mean, Minnesota, we're 48th or 49th in prison most years, and we're 8th in correctional supervision. You know, land of 10,000 probationers, I'd say, but there's way more than 10,000. Okay, so I won't dwell too much on individual effects here, except to point out, you know, some of the working hypotheses we had, and again, trying to engage this selection and causation. I'd say the strongest individual level effects, and Mike can speak more eloquently on this study, but the health and social behavior, we found what appears to be pretty strong evidence for depressed mood as a product of the prison experience. Less evidence, perhaps, for things like anxiety, panic, social phobia, where we also expected and anticipated to find effects. Let me move to community health, because I think this is work that's still under review, but I think is at least thought-provoking, and we could use your help, perhaps. We had the working hypothesis that states that had higher incarceration rates would have would have strong global effects on disease rates of all sorts. Largely coming from Mike's dissertation work, from Jason Schnicker's work on long-term effects of health of incarceration on health, what we found were much more contingent effects, and we couldn't. It took us a while to try to parse this out, but where there is robust testing and treatment, ex-prisoners having a large degree of ex-prisoners in circulation was associated with lower disease rates. Where there was very little testing and treatment, we found the opposite effect. I'll show you some pictures of this in a moment. We also found that the effect of incarceration seemed to change over time, particularly for something like HIV. We tried to get some leverage on these effects by comparing, say, people who were exposed to prison with people who were exposed to correctional sanction but without prison. There's no graduate students here, I don't think, but I like to tell graduate students I was exactly wrong about tuberculosis, at least if my model is correct. Sometimes you write a grant, you know, you think you'll find something you don't. But here I think is the kind of the key to unlocking some of these contingencies. 95% of prisoners were getting a TB test, and TB has a fairly difficult treatment regimen. And there's direct observation of treatment in prison. May not have great medical care, but again, maybe go back to Evelyn's work, it's that counterfactual. It's what's available in the community. How much health care, what's the quality of care that people are getting before they go to prison? HIV, I think this is up now, but it was 73% as routine screening. Syphilis, often screened, but then not chlamydia and gonorrhea, much more spotty there. And so when we looked at this, and I won't belabor individual regression coefficients, but the ex-prisoner effect, running a lot of people through the prison, seemed to be lowering rates of TB in our models, which means that I have to give a lot of presentations which I say, no, I'm not suggesting mass incarceration as a solution to America's healthcare problems. The and realizing that this is a difficult presents a difficult kind of set of policy choices. I won't go through the STDs, but quite consistent with things that are tested and treated having one effect and things that aren't another. I just say, in brief, in all of our models, as the study referenced earlier today, incarceration was increasing deaths from HIV/AIDS, but we did see this association decline greatly since 2003. Okay, let me move to spillovers on the system just briefly. Here's a spillover diagram from an article in Milbank, this year perhaps, that incarceration could affect healthcare utilization. If you have a lot of ex-prisoners in an area, you're likely to have a lot of uncompensated care, which could reduce services and diminish quality. This was one of our working hypotheses that seemed to bear out in the analysis. That is that high rates of ex-prisoners worsened most community health outcomes. And in particular, we looked at access to care and specialists, physician trust, and satisfaction with care, found effects on both capacity and quality of care available. And I think importantly for kind of understanding that we're all in this together, that getting far from the modal prisoner to look at people with insurance, people over 50 years of age, women, non-Hispanic whites, all of their healthcare choices and care were affected by the health of incarcerated, formerly incarcerated populations. Okay, policy moment. John and Holly, I just had to give a little shout out to you from the Children of Incarcerated Parents session that the Barr Foundation sponsored in NSF recently. I will go out on a limb a little bit and to say, think that prison effects on healthcare are real consequential, but they may not always be negative. And this is for somebody who's fairly cynical about how much prisons can do in terms of, say, employment and training, that it is a public health opportunity in the prisons themselves, but also that the health of prisoners is likely to affect other citizens and healthcare consumers. And I haven't gotten into the details of kind of how I'm trying to model this, and it very well could be the case that certain things I've said will fail to replicate, but I do believe that this basic connection will likely be found. So there is a tremendous interdependence of prisoners and others, and that these low community baselines will change. I mean, it is, I've had the experience of presenting this kind of set of work to European audiences recent years, for whom it makes a lot more sense that, well, you do, given the American healthcare system and the care that is available outside, it may not be so surprising that prisons are doing some of this good work. I will say I was asking everybody today about how optimistic they are about the future. I think there is a kind of a bipartisan consensus to some extent about the needs to address these health and the as well as punishment. I mean, I find when I testify in state legislatures, they're very concerned about the aging population, the shrinking workforce, and the message of having fewer prisoners and more taxpayers seems to go over pretty well on any side of the aisle. With the idea of, as well, that if we can detect excess punishment, then that's non-utilitarian. I will skip over some of the solutions or suggested reactions to different collateral sanctions to keep the focus on health here. But I will say that there has been a tremendous amount of change just in the last few years. So obviously, Affordable Care Act, we talked about that today. We really don't know. Like, my data today aren't speaking to the post-ACA world. With regard to work, though, we've had tremendous change. Over 20 states now ban the box. which removes the criminal record question from applications. In Minnesota, you can ask about a criminal record at the finalist stage or at the interview stage. We're not sure of that effect. That needs rigorous evaluation. But it is moving the needle in some sense. With the denial of welfare benefits for people with drug felonies, 12 states have opted out of that ban or reduced it, which I think reduces this piling on effect that I've mentioned. With voting, 24 states have expanded voting rights to over 1 million people since the late 1990s. And there's some tremendously exciting ongoing research on education, on monetary sanctions, on housing. I would say housing is perhaps, if I'm talking with people who are doing reentry services, housing is the big thing they're talking about. Every landlord seems to be upping the kind of scrutiny they're giving folks. As well, in the provision of healthcare services, the continuity of care seems to be what people are talking about. And there, I think we need a lot more work to understand this local variation across jurisdictions and across the United States. So I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Thank you. We've had great presentations on both the direct and indirect effects of criminal justice involvement on health. And we'd like to open up the table for comments or questions. John?
For John and Holly, I have a question and a suggestion. The question is, will the questions about health change in Wave 5? And a suggestion in terms of your very nice historical time era, I would put in the Affordable Care Act in there as well for Wave 5, so you could have to see the balance from something positive, perhaps, versus the Great Recession and the mass incarceration.
You may want to break it up by expansion states versus
exactly.
Non-expansion states.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there is a Wave 5 coming. Wave 4 is 2007-2008, so Wave 5 will be in the next year or so. So we will kind of have an opportunity to look at impact of the Affordable Care Act. And I won't try to pull up the slide, but Holly presented this slide that shows that in terms of the mediation of the effect of maternal incarceration on receiving health care, about 10% is due to having health insurance and about 30% due to economic insecurity. So we'd hope, you know, the impact of the Affordable Care Act would be to drive down the effect of economic insecurity. And that now currently looks like the dominant factor. And of course, that was a big part of the hopes and expectations about expansion of Medicaid as well as other parts of the Affordable Care Act. Yeah.
And John, was the other part of your question, will the health measures remain the same? So the thing is, I know I haven't seen the final questionnaire, but it's been constrained to 40 minutes. A lot has been.
Could you just repeat that for Chris?
Yes.
So the crime module and stuff?
I don't know. But I imagine there will be repeats of certain health measures. I don't know for a fact, no.
There actually will be a few added items about return. That we pushed for that and were able to get some help from NSF funding for those items.
Ingrid? Well, this is for all three of you. You guys have done a beautiful job of showing how these data can be used to answer sort of important health and social questions. And I guess I'm wondering where are the gaps still, because it makes it look sort of like We have this data available. So where do you see as the gaps, and what are the next steps, and how could you benefit from sort of an expansion of available data from some other national data sources?
Yeah, I can say for my work, certainly, we've been frustrated getting state-level variation as well as institution-level variation in the quality of care that's being done. I would say you know, I feel like the sort of work I've been doing is rather gross, trying to give us a, I mean, not disgusting, but trying to give us an aggregate picture, but not the sort of refined way that we can say, okay, if we provide this sort of care rather than this sort of care, we will have these outcomes.
One of the areas that we still, we wrote an annual review sociology paper kind of outlining where we hope research on parental incarceration effects will go. And we're really wanting to broaden thinking about context to kind of thinking about state context and really thinking about policy differences and how those can condition parental incarceration effects. So we're kind of hoping to broaden research to take into the context more. As well, more research needs to look at sort of this mixed patterning of effects that's showing up for maternal incarceration, and more people need to, I think, research that issue. Yeah.
I'll just say one more thing about the looking at the contextual effects across American states in terms of impacts of incarceration on parents and children. Some of you will know a much underappreciated classic study, though, by Catherine Beckett and Bruce Western on the effects of the punitiveness of regimes and that increase in that over time and the decrease in welfare support, not to mention things like health care. So those are things, those are kinds of variations that over time and across states that a national population survey like Ad Health is well positioned to address, and that's been the emphasis of the latest work we've tried to do in terms of getting funding from National Science Foundation for that work.
John and Holly, would the emphasis in the Ad Health continue to be on the parental side as opposed to the by now the individuals are adults, right? And they could be affecting children going forward.
This is exactly a key point, Ruth, that we're hoping ideally that the study will carry on and actually interview those children of the respondents. And we've got so much data on the respondents themselves. We've got just so many more control variables than we have at the moment for parental incarceration that we hope to be able to continue to test these hypotheses.
Yes, we've got about 15 years of the children's lives now covered in Ad Health. And do we know the proportion who have had children by the fourth wave?
We do, but I don't remember.
Right now. Well, it'll be higher in wave
five. Well, most of them will, because now they're in their mid-30s when they're being interviewed, so most of them will have children. But that questions a little bit the effects of parental incarceration that you presented today are really on adult outcomes, not child outcomes. And so we want to be clear about that. And we would expect similar findings. But I would use this opportunity to say, I love the Ad Health, big fan, but they're getting old, right? And we need some new data with new generations and new cohorts who are living through the experiences of the different contexts today. But just my own personal plug. So, Alexis.
So I was very intrigued by the data that John and Holly have regarding food insecurity and how it's greater when there's maternal imprisonment versus paternal imprisonment. So I was just trying to think about some of the causes for that. And I was just curious to know, I was thinking about two different ideas and just want to throw them out. So what I was thinking about, possibly, do you think that oftentimes moms have greater social capital, and that in terms of the fact that they can reach out to their grandmother or their mother, the grandmother of the child, or their sisters, the aunt of the child, or even their neighbors. And so when they're in prison, that social capital sort of ebbs away. And that might have a greater, that's why there's maybe more of an impact on food insecurity with maternal imprisonment, looking at social capital. But the other thing that I was also thinking about is I don't know whether or not you all were able to look at, see if there were any interaction effects in terms of whether or not some of those moms that have been in prison, that also a portion of them were also involved in relationships with men who had also been in prison. So looking at sort of that dual incarceration effect, and maybe while the mother's in prison, maybe the father's not, but has a history of having been incarcerated. So I just wondered whether or not there was any interaction effects there.
Oh, I was just going to say, there's been some work by Rosalyn Lee, who I believe works for the CDC, and she actually looked at the combined effect of paternal and maternal imprisonment on health outcomes. And her results were strongest for fathers and then sort of sparser for mothers and then combined as well. So I would just refer you to her work there. On the social capital?
I think the other thing I wanted to say was I think this is the first line of questions, and they're extremely important. And I also want to follow up, though, on Wendy and Ruth's comments about the turnover in the ad-health population of parents, respondents, and then their own children. You know, one of the sort of classic findings of John and Rob Sampson's research is change across the entire life course and through adulthood. And one of the interesting things in Chris and Sarah Wakefield's research is the finding that there is an increase in the use of foster care with maternal incarceration. And we really don't know a lot about what happens after foster care and how Medicaid is linked into these arrangements. And we've only recently sort of begun to sort of see that that was probably significant, and are interested in trying to see the ways of pushing that part of the long-term data forward. Yeah.
Oh, Elizabeth?
Yes. I just wanted to say, no, Mike here. Okay. Oh, you give her the hand. Thank you. Okay, I'm going to talk a little bit tomorrow about the National Longitudinal Survey's view. And I am not an expert at all in any shape or form on the incarceration.
Check the mic again.
Is it
you
on?
Have to talk louder.
Is it on?
Just speak louder.
I'll just speak. How about that?
No.
That's
no,
one of my
it
classes.
Needs to be recorded.
Is it? Can you?
Can you hear it?
Can you hear it over there?
Yeah, so the
okay,
mic,
good.
Right,
okay.
The mic is more for the transcription amplification, but this
transcribe away and I'll still yell. So I know there is not, the 97 are mostly, the NLSY 97 are mostly the data that are used for the crime statistics. But there are still a few questions in the 79, we shouldn't forget that there are children, all the children born to the women, at least, are followed. And so we do have some data there for any of you interested in doing the second generation. And, of course, those children now range in age from, I should know this since I'm PI for the child and the young adult, shouldn't I? I think they range from age 4 to 44. And there's 11,000, over 11,000 children born to the women. So you've got, you know, got some good data to use there too.
Okay, I think we have Daniel and then and then Mike
and then Marcy.
Okay.
I was wondering about alternative data sets that I haven't heard discussed. And two that come to mind are, one is the Pathways to Desistance study, which for those of you who are unaware of it, is a sample of about 1,500 juvenile, well, they're now adults, but who had came into contact with the criminal justice system in Philadelphia and Maricopa County. I believe they were all adjudicated. They committed a crime or were or charged with a crime that they could be adjudicated as adults. But the key thing I want to bring to your attention is that because the PI Ed Mulvey is a clinical psychologist. They collect huge amounts of data mm-hmm. on the services that were received by these individuals, and this gets back to this discussion of this is a kind of a black box going on here about the quality of care that they're receiving. I don't know. I've worked with people mm-hmm. on this data on other kinds of projects. I don't know for a fact, but I would be amazed if they don't ask them questions about health status kinds of questions as well. So that's one thing. And then the other source of data I haven't heard discussed is administrative data. Mm-hmm. So for example, for a different purpose, as an example, I'm working with data from Pennsylvania, where we have everybody who was convicted in the Pennsylvania courts from 1998 to 2000, and we've linked it with their Department of Corrections records and their rap sheets. Now, our purpose for the Department of Corrections kind of thing was we were interested in the effects of incarceration on recidivism to know when they were released or not. But I would imagine that these Department of Corrections, that in their record systems, they do have information about the health of the inmate and so forth. And it would seem to me that that would be a really valuable source of information for studying effectively dose response relationships. For how length of incarceration is related to different outcomes.
Thank you. Mike, I think you
had a I had a question for Chris, but certainly Holly and John could respond. Thinking about this notion of sort of piling on, and you ended fairly optimistically thinking mm-hmm. about, a million new people had the opportunities to vote. And the backdrop to my question is I just finished Arlie Bilibin's book, Give Us the Ballot, and his basic argument is that, in fact, 30 states have enacted restrictions that are preventing mm-hmm. people from voting. And mm-hmm. so are you more optimistic on what's happening, or is it we sort of give a little here and take a look, take some away here and maintain a status quo? Just be interested in your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think the general direction is toward reenfranchisement of disenfranchised felons. But voting restrictions is a much broader class of that's out there. But I do think there's some growing awareness of the of how collateral sanctions affect individual lives and reentry and reintegration. I think 10 years ago people were saying, well, we can't even hope to catalog them. It would just be impossible. And the Barr Foundation, NIJ, there's been real, tremendous efforts there that help us understand it. But the downside is that with technology, the records themselves are much stickier, and it is very difficult. It's much more widely known. It's much more widely asked, and so. It's harder to leave a criminal past in the rearview mirror today.
Marcy, did you have a comment?
Got a mic for you here.
To the question of alternative data sources, I would recommend that you look at the National Survey of Children in Non-Parental Care. It is a follow-up survey to the National Survey of Children's Health. It's very large. And this, the follow-up survey looked at children in formal and informal foster care situations, kin care, and the adverse childhood experiences module was administered. So you would know which children had experienced parental incarceration.
Which organization?
National Center for Health Statistics.
Thank you for sharing that. Candace, you had a comment?
Yeah, this goes to Holly and John. Did you have, and the food, in the Alexis made me think of this, the food insecurity and maternal imprisonment. Was the timing on those such that you could tell that the food insecurity occurred while mom was imprisoned? Or is it, no? Because I was going to say, in my experience, it may have nothing to do with her imprisonment as much as it does addiction. So that when she's addicted, she uses all any child support she's getting, any welfare benefits she's getting to feed her drugs, and there's no food in the house. So it's just a possible alternative explanation for why you find that relationship.
Yeah, it's very important to think about. And we will, in the next wave, we'll be able to do a fixed effects kind of thing with maternal incarceration effects on economic insecurity, won't we?
Well, maternal effects will be measured again.
Yeah, so, yeah, in wave five.
Yeah. No, that's an important point. Thank you.
Ingrid, did you have a question?
Oh, I was just going to add a comment about, in response to your question about Department of Corrections medical records. There is data available, obviously, in medical records in state and federal and county criminal justice agencies that provide health care. Our experience, I mean, we've done a case control study where we abstracted health records from the Washington Department of Corrections, and it took about an hour and a half per chart to just get selected items out of that medical record, because it's a paper chart and they're stored centrally. And then, of course, people who are active in the system, you have to go to that facility to get the chart, pull it, and bring it to the central location to abstract it. So it's pretty time intensive, although it certainly can be done. And I think it provides useful data. The promise is really electronic health records in the correctional health system. The problem is that some of them are proprietary, and so it's actually hard to get access to the data from those. But I think to the extent, and of course everyone probably uses different medical records within corrections, they may not all be on the same platform. So, and there's a lot of information that needs to be, a lot of sort of harmonizing that needs to be done in order to use that data in a useful way. But that is certainly something that we've been talking to BJS about, possibly, and certainly the federal system might be able to find ways of, and has to some extent used that data before to give us some interesting prevalence estimates for certain diseases, and can give us some quality of care indicators as well as outcomes.
I just, with regard to the cost of dealing with text material. Keep in mind that, you know, that there's revolutions going on in computer science departments, like at CMU, in text processing of these kinds of cases, which could tremendously increase the efficiency of extracting useful information from those records.
I think David Johnson had a comment.
So a lot of plug-in data sets. The panel study of infant dynamics has the same set of variables, except they've asked the actual parents their incarceration status, and then they look at outcomes from the kids. So I think Rucker Johnson at Berkeley has some of the similar results. I wouldn't necessarily believe you're ever incarcerated, but I just looked at his results and was getting the same thing, the whites and blacks of kids who had ever incarcerated fathers and mothers. So I think if you look at that, they've also asked, so I think you started to ask the young adults their incarceration status, so you could then look at their parents related to the kids and so on and so on. So I think there's a lot of other data sets that you can do next
that's really
analysis
useful.
To compare.
Thank you.
I see Amanda Geller has a comment.
So I wanted to also add on to the potential for using Department of Corrections and state correctional agencies data. I'll talk a little more about this tomorrow as part of my Fragile Families discussion, but we actually got New York State's Division of Criminal Justice Services to match our respondents' identifiers to records within their system that had been reported up from police departments. So there's a lot of potential, also a lot of pitfalls, which I'll talk about tomorrow, but kind of for the bigger, kind of more global issues, I want to just mention it took about 5 years to get this done, partly because of the IRB and funding. Like, once you're talking about opening up the personal identifiable information of people participating in national surveys and matching to other records, there's complexity involved. Not to say that it couldn't be done, and I actually think with new studies, some of the challenges could be headed off at the beginning, initial consents and things like that, but it's something that needs to be thought about.
Yeah, John?
Quick question for Chris. I can't resist asking. This new voting while on probation, this is VWP, I think, or something. Anyway, this is interesting, all this variation. Do we have a sense, do these restrictions, I should know this, I assume, but I don't, do these restrictions affect voting in primaries? this would have a significant impact.
They do. I mean, there was a very nice Atlantic piece recently, some of you might have seen, about Puerto Rican prisoners being able to vote in the primary, the Republican primary. And if I'm not mistaken, it was a sizable percentage of the voters, 25% or something like that, of the voters were incarcerated. And obviously, we do have voting in prison absentee in Maine and Vermont, but I'm not remembering the author's name, but he did a nice job of suggesting, well, this helps to show the feasibility of this civic inclusiveness.
So one of the, you know, in your locked out book, you show these elections that would have turned out differently.
That's right.
So there may be kind of a process transition thing with selection that goes on earlier stages.
Exactly. I mean, that's really the spillover. The spillover diagram was partly, you know, that's a health spillover argument, but it really, we use the same spillover logic in modeling the effect of disenfranchisement on political elections. And I was just on a German dissertation committee where the student was arguing that this effect managed to push candidates toward the center rather than anywhere else. But I didn't quite believe it because we're on tape. But but it was a creative argument.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, I'd like to thank the authors and the speakers. And we're. Oh, I'm sorry, Chris. I didn't see you right here. You got. Mm. You got. We have 5 minutes.
We can end early.
No. Go ahead. Go ahead. You can have the last word before. Go ahead.
The only two things that this made me think about, so first, John and Holly, you guys were talking about sort of how there's debate about the maternal incarceration effects. And I guess that's part of why I think thinking about this more in like a risk factors kind of approach is maybe a better way for us to think about future questions. Because like, we disagree about whether there are real effects. We don't disagree about whether they're a vulnerable public health population that needs interventions. And so it was just something that I was thinking about during your presentation. I mean, the other thing that I was thinking about a little bit, and, you know, is maybe just like something that we'll have to wrestle with. So, like, you know, all these like longitudinal studies where you can get information on parental imprisonment, I think can be used creatively to look at the effects of parental imprisonment on kids, but for the most part, we don't have particularly good health measures on the kids in those studies. Mm-hmm. And so I guess, like, if we're really trying to focus on the health component of things, like, PSID has been going since, like, before 15 years before I was born, and that's awesome. Like, there's all this, like, super rich information that we have for such a long period of time, but, like, the health measures are, you know, like good, but not as good as we get in one of these big sort of health surveys. So I guess, I don't know. I mean, I think it was just making me think a little bit about like next steps if we're really trying to tie it directly to health, and that might be a way to go. And if it sounds like Emily and I are in cahoots, it's only because we are. That's it.
Okay. Maybe you could elaborate a little more on what you mean by specifically by health effects. I was kind of thinking back to this ability to get up and walk across the room as, you know, I mean, that's maybe useful for something, but how's that going to help us get rid of this problem?
Has an answer for you.
Polony has an answer to it.
The get up and go.
Oh, that was what Mike talked about with Alberto Poloni's measure of health. So your question is, how are these surveys getting at that kind of pressure?
Well, I mean, if you measure someone's blood pressure, it's kind of a measurement. It's something that you have, and it's a real predictor of good or bad things to come.
Death.
But asking somebody.
Death. It's of death. Yeah. I mean, it's a strong measured health outcome that physicians use, that we use to predict. We can say a person's lifetime probability of dying of death. You know, so it's a measured health outcome.
I mean, everybody's going to die at some point.
Right. But you can predict based
when,
on.
I would sort of fall pretty much completely on your side in terms of needing these more objective health measures. So linking those to family incarceration instead of having the standard measures that we have in the big longitudinal studies. And I think partially, I mean, to be honest too, it's just like a really pragmatic reason in that, like, you're not going to place anything in top medical journals that get folks more broadly interested in this issue without objective health measures. Like Emily and Mike and John and Holly and like a bunch of us working in this area, like, the ceiling is like two steps below JAMA or New England Journal because you don't have these objective health measures, and so it doesn't get the sort of funding and attention that it could get
otherwise.
But
even if you have them, wouldn't you need measures of pre-existing conditions? Okay, so you measure blood pressure while they're in prison. Wouldn't you want to know if they had high blood pressure before prison?
So you would want to know, but if you're doing a risk factors approach, you just want to know how much being in prison was associated with elevated odds of having high blood pressure. So it doesn't have to, the like longitudinal component of things that we'd want in a more broadly sort of social scientific perspective doesn't apply in the same way to like the public health research.
I mean, I'll just add to this, which isn't to say that this is the end all be all. This is the starting point. But from a national statistics point of understanding the prevalence of diseases, we don't have an understanding for this population because we don't have measures that simultaneously, albeit poorly, but, you know, measure criminal justice exposure, however we want to define that, and objective measures of health. And this is how dollars are portioned to states. This is how we keep records. This is how we actually track disparities, racial disparities, class disparities in health and health outcomes. We don't have that. So I strongly push, which is that the measures of health ought to be objective measures of health, in my opinion, for the first step.
Okay, that's a good way to segue to a break. We will come back at 3:15 for our last session of the day, which should be very interesting. Thank you. Yeah,